So let us read, open the scriptures and read, beginning at Revelations 17, and we'll read verse 1, read a whole chapter, go right through and read every verse, and then we'll begin the message. It says, "And there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, and I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore, or harlot, that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abomination nations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled, I wondered with great admiration or amazement. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore dost thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, with whom the seven heads and ten horns, which hath the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. And here is a mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he, is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition or destruction. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. And he said unto me, The waters which thou sawest where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God hath put into their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and to give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth." May God bless the reading of his word to us. Now, I wonder, in reading this, if you were if you're so confused as I was when I first read this. It just seems quite complex, and I hope at the end of it that you will not be more confused, but then you will be helped in a way, at least a little bit, by what I have to share with this. It hasn't been an easy chapter to study at all for me, and I will have to confess some of the things that I've been gleaning have been coming from, and the things I will share have come from gleanings from different books and different commentaries to give help in my understanding of this. So here we begin in chapter 17 and verse 1. It carries on from chapter 16 and how the vials, the bowls of judgment, have been carried out, and I believe that this picture here of John seeing the great harlot and this whole scene I believe actually is John is going back in time. It's not necessarily consequentially. It's John is all of a sudden given that the angel just stops everything and explains this situation and the destruction of the ecclesiastical Babylon or the spiritual Babylon. So the invitation of John to come here, he is invited to come by the angel, one of the seven angels which hath the seven vials. In verse 1, it says he is invited to come hither. Come here and I will show you. Come and view the judgment of the great harlot, the great whore that he's speaking about here. And so we see in Revelation that there is great judgment of the Lord coming upon an entity here, this ancient religious apostate amalgamation with Christianity, or in the Old Testament with the children of Israel, and how it caused them often to commit spiritual adultery, and has come into the church age that God is going to ultimately take them up, and he will judge them. And God is a God of justice. We often think, as you think of some of the saints that we've gone through in Revelations, those under the altar and other ones who cry out their blood for avenging our blood, but vengeance is mine. We get from this chapter here, we'll see in Revelation 17 and 18, God taking up both the ecclesiastical and the political Babylon, both of them. And they will come under God's scrutiny. He will turn his eye upon them. And there's going to be judgment. There's going to be vengeance. As those saints were called not to take vengeance. How many times in our lives, and even those here, those martyrs of Jesus, how many times in our lives are we told to not take vengeance? Because vengeance is mine. I will repay. And when he says I will, he means I will. And we can take great comfort. We think there in Luke 18, where it says, where God's elect cry day and night. He says, I will avenge speedily when the time comes. Though they cry, they cry day and night unto him. It seems like he doesn't hear. It says he will hear, and he will avenge speedily. And so here we can see this historic apostate or religious entity of Babylon, which is carried on from the Old Testament right into this modern day, and it's going to be taken up by God. Those who've killed God's saints, God has taken account, and he will judge them. So it takes place here. John is invited here to come see the judgment. Come and behold. And it's almost like God takes pleasure here. See, there is a day coming where there will be ultimate judgment, that God is going to vindicate himself and his saints. He is going to vindicate. And that's a great comfort for us as a people of God. So both chapter 17 and 18 are dedicated to the destruction of Babylon, both in its two forms, ecclesiastical, which is chapter 17, and the political, which is chapter 18. God is going to bring them up in judgment. So the timeline, I believe this timeline here is the judgment of this great harlot precedes a great amount of time, it says, before the seven vile judgments. Chapter 17, I believe, is at the end of the first 3.5 years. So there's a 7-year period of the tribulation. And there's the first 3.5 years and the last 3.5 years. But I believe this takes place in the first 3.5 years, relatively, I believe, towards the end of the first 3.5 years, before the beast, the Antichrist, takes place of God to be worshipped alone, and he destroys this woman, this entity here, by God's judgment upon her. So I think the timeline is at the end of the first 3.5 year tribulation. And so we think of John here is shown the destruction of Babylon as representing false religion. What does Babylon here mean? And it speaks of the woman is a symbol of Babylon, as a symbol of Babylon, described, and it's quite the language, as a great harlot, a great whore, who is seen sitting on many waters. And waters here are the many nations where she has control over. She's just sitting on all the waters. She has her hand in everywhere. And everyone seems to be affected by this woman. The scope is many waters. The inhabitants of the whole earth she's covering. She's touching. She is influencing all of them. The influence that she has over the waters, all the peoples. So her scope is great. This is not just a little place here and a little cult here. This is the whole, it's affecting everywhere. This Babylon, this woman here. And this woman is described as having committed fornication. They think of how the inhabitants of the earth described as being made drunk from the wine of her fornication. And so we think of this, the picture of this woman being utterly evil. Evil woman, if you look at the description of her, it is like this evil woman and how it signifies spiritual adultery. So it has a form of outwardly and religiously looking like the real thing, but actually being completely untrue in its relationship. There's no real genuine relationship with the God that they profess. There's a church, and we'll go into the details of it. Spiritual adultery here in this situation is not usually used of heathen nations, because they have no connection. The heathen nations have no connection to the true God. So there's no sense of an adultery or unfaithfulness in that regard. It's usually not spoken of people who have no connection with God in this way. But it is often used of Israel. It is often used of ancient Israel in their apostasy and how they had a link with the true God, but how they were apostate often in their spiritual adultery from the covenant that God has given them to the true God. They went whoring after other idols, after Baal, after all these gods. So the children of Israel went after them, and that often speaks of spiritual adultery. And also it's a warning against the church, for the church, the true church. In James 4, it speaks of that, how we're to be a warning against having an alliance with this false church or false gods. So it's been very difficult to kind of understand the full, because there's so many varied different arguments or different interpretations that people have with this. So it hasn't been really an easy, clean-cut, this is what it says, because someone else says this about this, and this means this. There's so many different avenues you can go down. But I'll just give it a sort of a general, trying to give an understanding of this. So you can see here there's an amalgamation, there's an alliance, an apostate church with political powers in this chapter here. And I want to say this, false religion, and here this is the picture, is always the worst enemy of true religion or the truth. It's false religion. It's the worst enemy, the worst kind. It's the hardest. It's also the hardest to win those to Christ who've been affected by this false system. It really is. I remember just a couple of weeks ago being in Brandon at the fair, and often just talking to a normal person, it is they're not so antagonistic, you might think. Sometimes, of course, they are, just because we're naturally against the gospel. The gospel naturally offends people. We ought not to go out if we don't expect to offend people, because the gospel goes against man, and it goes against the pride of man. It goes against how depraved we are, how sinful we are, and it just, the natural man doesn't like hearing this. It's like, I can't do anything. I'm lost. you tell me I'm not good enough, because a natural man loves to do something to be saved. But here, I remember talking to, it's a difference talking to just a normal person, as it were, or someone that has been affected by this apostate religion, Christianity, really, in its outward form, and has been, as it were, he's been, it's affected him in a negative way. And there's a man that came to me, and he started cursing at me, at me there, and like, this is, beep, beep, beep. And it took me aback, and I'm like, this is not normal. This is not a normal person. Is he under the influence? Is he, what is this? But actually, it's because after calming him down and chatting with him, he said that he has been in the church, and how he's been affected by the falsehood and the lack of reality in the church. And he was very against even hearing about the gospel. Like, and that's how I was thinking. False religion is the worst enemy of the truth. It really is. It gives the and so that was an example to me. And as I was studying this, I could see some of the church in this form is the worst kind of position to be in. So the union of the apostate church here with the world and its political powers causes the wicked drunkenness as far as spiritual things are concerned. And I think of what William MacDonald said in one of the things I read. He thinks that this woman here is also, he believes, so there's different views. He says this religious Babylon, which is signifying the woman here, as religious, the ecclesiastical Babylon, he says certainly includes apostate Christendom. But then he says both Protestant and Catholic. He says it may well represent the ecumenical church. Now that's William MacDonald saying this. The ecumenical church, which is the amalgamation of all of us just joining together in one. All the church outside, everyone just joining together in one. And he believes that this great spiritual, not the real church, but the under the guy, the thing of Christianity, the name of Christianity, but linking together in one. And that's linking together the Catholics with the Orthodox, with Protestants. Here it says it could represent all of that, that whole ecumenical movement, but those are not the truth, not the real church, he says. And when the rapture happens, it's going to be exposed what the truth was, who the real ones were, the ones who trusted in Christ alone for salvation, who were indwelt with the Spirit, will be taken away before the tribulation period. And then this whole church will still be here on the earth, and it's going to be still part of this world here in this form. So we think of verse 3 here. It says, so he carried me away in the wilderness, in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness in her of her fornication. So here, the woman, and some of these things I'm going to say are actually from some commentaries I've gained, and I'll reference it here. The woman here representing false religion, it says here, sits upon a scarlet-colored beast. And this beast would have been, we've already talked about this beast there in chapter 13, where Brother Daniel was taking up. And most commentaries I've read spoke of this as the revived Roman Empire in its character, as a center of world government, of Gentile power in that day, in the coming day. This could be very near. This could be very near to us as we see the signs of the times coming. And verse 3, the woman sits upon this beast. So she's riding upon He said, the fact that this woman is riding the beast and not the beast itself, and she's not the beast itself, this woman, but she's riding on the beast, signifies that she represents ecclesiastical powers and distinct from the beast, which is the political power. So the beast has political power, but this woman is different. She's riding on this beast. So what's the idea of riding on this beast? What can we take from that? Well, she is supported. She is, as riding on it, she is supported by the powers, the political powers of the beast of that day, the political powers. She's supported by it. But in riding the beast, think about this, she has a dominant role in outward directing the beast. So notice that the two distinct things. She is being supported by it, being on it, by this political government, this one world government, one day in the revived Roman Empire and in the figure, the one world leader. But she is different in the sense of that she is controlling it, in having the dominant role as being controlled and directing it, at least outwardly, it seems to be the case here. So we think of this. That's why I believe this is prior to the later part of the first 3.5 years, or the start of the 3.5 years at the end, where the beast, because the beast doesn't yet, she's still having control over him in a way. But we read at the end of this chapter how the beast that she's riding on is going to judge her. They're going to hate the whore, the woman, this harlot, and he's going to kill her. This beast that she's supported, by being supported by. And I believe that happens in the midpoint when the beast takes up the power and wants to be worshipped himself. Not now underneath this woman or being directed or dominated by this false apostate church, but this beast that she's riding on wants to have the full control, wants to have the full worship as God in the temple. So he's going to destroy this woman. But it's actually according to the divine will of God. God's judgment is going to fall upon this woman. So I believe it's the first half of Daniel's 70th week there. Think of how here of the beast in the names of blasphemy. It says full of the names of blasphemy, this scarlet-colored beast that's full of names of blasphemy. And that's very reminiscent of what we've already covered there in chapter 13, or Daniel covered, of that beast that takes the worship upon himself. That's why it's blasphemous. He's going to take that, it's blasphemy, taking the place of God. What a wicked thing to do. And that's why here's, it even says how this beast is full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, he's right now kind of just giving a description of what John is seeing. But in chapter, verse 7 to the end, from verse 1 to 6, John is speaking of what he sees, just the description of what he sees. But in verse 7 to the end, the angel gives him the interpretation of what he is seeing. So the angel will take up what John is marveling at and seeing. John is just giving a description here. But verse 7 and onward, the angel unfolds to him what it actually means, these things. So we're going to go into that. But the 7 horns, 7 heads and 10 horns, there in verse 3, is, and there's different views on this, but I think the one that was most helpful to me is the 7 heads are forms of government which are successive. So they're one after the other, and then the next one, and then the next one. 7 heads. But the 10 horns are kings who will reign simultaneously at one time. So that was what I found helpful, is the 7 heads. So it gives you the historic sort of picture that this has been going on for history. And this this great whore, this great harlot, has been riding historically, which goes back to Babylon. That's where this all comes from. And has been riding historically on these empires, these kingdoms, as heads, different successive heads of great world empires. But then the ten horns speaks of at one time, those ten kings are going to reign simultaneously at one time. So that's what I understand this to be. And so it just shows that this woman is linked with such a beast of blasphemy. It just shows the depth of apostasy, the depth of the apostasy of the false church here. And so closely linked with the beast with such blasphemies is really quite something, a wicked state, really, of this. And then it says here in the description of the woman decked in purple and scarlet with gold, precious stones, and pearls. And here, I'm just going to read what someone says here. It says, all too familiar when you read about these things. In themselves, the scarlet and the purple are spiritual pictures that we read in the scriptures. But here, this false church puts it upon herself. This woman, who is an adulteress, is taking what is the real thing and appropriating it to herself. But she's inwardly, and the Bible doesn't quote or gloss over what is in that cup. It's full of abominations. God says exactly what it is. It might outwardly look good, like she's dressed in this scarlet and purple. It looks like the real thing, and a golden cup in her hand. But what's in the cup? God shows us what's in this cup. It is full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication, it says. So someone here said about this description, he says, it's all too familiar with the awful trappings and vestures and robes and outward religiosity of the high officials of the Roman Catholic Church and also the Greek Orthodox Church and the like. Those outward robes, those outward looking like the real thing. And people get deceived by this. What is it? Over billions of people. The figure today is over billions of people get deceived by this religion or by these religion outward shows. They look holy. They look at holy men. They dress a certain way. It looks like it's a real deal, which actually, in truth, it has nothing to do with Christianity. If you look at the core of it and where the religion comes from, it's just adopted. And that's really what I think this is, this woman. This is this church, which is the voice of the martyrs, and we'll go over this. This Roman church, from history, has adopted the Babylonian thing, religion unto itself, and has worshipped the same deities. And in doing so, in the early church, in Christianity, hundreds of years after Christ, and the church was formed, they adopted adopted Christianity unto itself. But just give different names. They still have the same stuff, the same core false pagan religion. They've adopted Christianity unto itself, but it's not Christianity. And it's been proven in their martyrdom of the true saints and the true church. Whenever there's a revival, it's tried to squash it and kill it. Why? Because they hate it. They hate the truth because you're not of the truth. And so that's why some of these commentators that I read here are giving have been older back in the 1800s. Some of these commentators, some are more modern. But it says here, purple and scarlet, rich spiritual meaning, are here prostituted with the false religious apostate church here. And here, Alford, a guy named Alford, states. He says, I do not hesitate, therefore, to maintain the interpretation which regards papal and not pagan Rome as pointed out by the harlot of this vision. So he takes the view of the Roman Catholic Church where it's originated, and that's what it was in the power. Rome was in power when Christ died and when the temple was destroyed, Rome was in power, but then there's a seemingly ceasing of it, or at least it kind of disappeared as a world power and as a world Gentile power. But it seems to be it's going to be resurrected at the end as this global head of a superpower, a world superpower. It's going to rule this world and in its one leader as well, this leader. So the golden cup of abominations and filthiness of fornication. You can see how God does not spare language of this in this area here. And it says here in verse 5, it speaks of, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I read a guy named Wolford, which actually was very, very helpful. He has this book on Revelations, the revelation of Jesus Christ, and the whole book. It was suggested to me by someone very close to me, and given to me, this book. And I've been studying the last few weeks. And he has some really good things to say here. I'll just quote something, what he says here, of Babylon the Great, the mother of her hearts. And he says, and I quote, "It has been commonly held that the title Babylon the Great assigned to this woman is not a reference to Babylon as a city or to Babylonia as a nation, but a religious designation, namely that the woman corresponds religiously to what Babylon was religiously. The meaning is made clear by her description as the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. It has been noted by many writers that the iniquitous and pagan rites of Babylon crept into the early church and were largely responsible for the corruptions incorporated in Roman Catholicism from which Protestantism separated itself in the Middle Ages." The Dark Ages were because of this pagan religion, this apostate religion that looked like Christianity, but it was not Christianity. And when Luther, the 95 Theses, remember this, how the Great Reformation started, look at the blood of the martyrs. Look how they killed, they squashed God's people. But God would triumph, and there was a great Reformation coming out from this. But you can see how this is Babylon the Great. It is great in its character, in the sense of it's been the head of this religion way back. And it says the mother is a source. It's a source of this false church has a source linking back. And it's of course all satanic. This goes way back, and we'll go into a little bit of the history here. The subject of Babylon is a prominent theme. It's a prominent theme in the Bible, this Babylon. It keeps coming up, especially at the end here in Revelation. But this has been going on throughout the history of Israel in the Old Testament. This Babylon is often often their gods were worshipped by the people of Israel, and if Babel, the origin of this name was first mentioned in Genesis 10. So this is where you get the first mention of Babel, where the city of Babel is mentioned. In verse 9 of Genesis 10, it says of Nimrod, it says that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. It says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So Babylon in scripture refers to the great system of religious error. And how do we, what was the start of Babylon? We think of how it was back when, remember, the Tower of Babel was erected, and it was seen as this way of getting to God, man getting to God, and God confused them. God gave them a language that they didn't understand, so they were confused by this language. And every man spoke in a different language. They just started speaking. All of a sudden, I would speak in a different language, and you wouldn't understand me. So much for building this great, mighty thing to get to God. And God confounded the languages. And so we can see here how it is, as it were, a way of getting to God, man trying to reach up to heaven, getting to God on their own way, not God's way, but by themselves. This was not God telling them how to get to heaven. They just try to do it their own way. It's really a counterfeit. It's a counterfeit religion. And it plagued Israel in the Old Testament, and as well as the church in the New Testament. And so we think of how the tremendous influence this had of the simplicity of the early church as well into the confusion that is today, the utter confusion. And it will be the worst after rapture of the church. So again, one of the writers says here, he says, and I quote, "Babylon is the source of the counterfeit religion, sometimes in the form of pseudo, which means false or not genuine, counterfeit Christianity, sometimes in the form of pagan religion. Its most confusing form, however, is found in Romanism," he says here. So we think of this confusing place that these people are in. And we think of Babylon, didn't just how it originated, but how it continued. We think of Nebuchadnezzar there in its greatest glory. Babylon's greatest glory was in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, who lived 600 years before Christ came. Nebuchadnezzar, that was the glory, the height of the Babylonian Empire. And it was one of the world religions. We think of Babylon, and we think of afterwards it was Medo-Persia, the world religion, and it was Greece, and then it was Rome. And so you can see how these great world empires were all had their different timelines in the ancient world. But the reign of Nebuchadnezzar was the height, the greatest of their world glory that they had. And so I'll just give a little bit of history of this, and then I'll finish, just so we understand where this, how this, what do they believe? What did the Babylonians believe early on, and how is that coming to our day and adapted itself? How does it work? Well, I'll quote someone here. It says, "In addition to materials given in the Bible itself," which is right now in Revelations, so in addition to the scriptural, what we read in the scriptures, different ancient accounts speak of the wife of Nimrod, who founded the city of Babylon. She became the head of the Babylonian mystery religion. Her name was Semiramis. Now, you can look this up yourself. This is easy to be found. It says, she was the high priestess of the idol worship. According to extra-biblical records, which have been preserved, Semiramis gave birth to a son who she claimed was conceived miraculously. The son, given the name of Tammuz, was considered a savior of his people and was, in effect, a false messiah, purported to be the fulfillment of the promise given to Eve. And then the legend of the mother and child was incorporated into the religious rites, and it's been repeated in various pagan forms throughout history. So what it's saying is there's a Nimrod, going back to Babylon, his wife, so that's why I think the link with Babylon is very important to understand. His wife, Semiramis, was a high priestess, and actually in Jeremiah, two times it speaks about this. It speaks of Jeremiah in Jeremiah 7, verse 18, and in Jeremiah 44, 17 to 19, she is referred to as the Queen of Heaven. How the children of Israel bowed down to the queen and gave gifts to the queen of heaven. So this was a woman that was worshipped. And also, her son, whose name was Tammuz, was said to be miraculously conceived. Very interesting. And when this Tammuz, in the ancient writings, was how he was told that he died, he was killed by wild beast, but then he rose again afterwards to be a savior of his people. Now you tell me, have you ever seen this in any other religion where the mother is worshipped and the child, both of them? You can see it's come down through the ages, picked up by Romanism before Babylon, the Babylonian false religion, pagan religion. This same God has come down in different forms, applied different people, different names to it. The mother name is Mary. The son's name is Jesus. We're worshiping the same God. We're believing the same thing. It's Christianity. No, it's not. It's false. It's wicked. It is, as God says here, it is the origin. It is the source. It's Babylon. But it's come down. It's the blood of the martyrs. The saints have been killed. It's unlimited amount. And one day God's going to take it up. And I thought it was very important to kind of give the background of this, because we often are ignorant about these things. We don't know where it comes from and how it is adapted after time. But we see it. It's just been different names given to it. It's not Christianity. This is falsehood, wickedness. And we do well to because they kill the saints. And one day, God's going to take them up. And God's going to give them what he desires, is judgment. And he will take it up and he'll do what he sees best in his justice. So, I mean, it has been very confusing to study this, or to initially, at least for me it was initially, but then as I was just going through it, and some commentators have really helped me, I hope that some of these things, if you have any questions, you can ask me, and I'll try to help in this way, and I hope it didn't make it more confusing, but may it be a help to you. I know it's been kind of scattered a little bit, but maybe a help to you in one way or another. May God bless his word. Let's pray.